The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today, the creator of Mouton Noir Wines, it is Andre Mack. Andre, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Hey, I have to clarify one thing.
Yeah.
It's Maison Wines now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. My bad.
I just don't want, you know, I was in a legal battle with you-know-who.
Yes.
For time, and so it is Maison Noir. I think internally we probably still call it the Mouton. It's just hard not to, but
yes.
I just wanted to throw that out.
Absolutely. We are talking with the creator of Maison Noir Wines. Just in case anyone in France or maybe another country, who knows where, is upset.
Yeah, we don't want to confuse anybody, right?
Right.
Confusion before, right?
Yeah. So there is so much to get to your own journey getting into wine, the philosophy behind it. Was there moments in your development where you felt lonely as probably one of the few African Americans in the wine community? But of course, I need to start with the television show Frasier. And were you as upset as I during the Toastmasters episode? They didn't smell the wine when Niles and Frasier were doing battle over their wine tasting skills. They never smelt it.
No, they didn't. But you know, this show, it had its shortcomings, right? But it was, you know, some of the information was pretty accurate. You know, I felt like I knew 61 Bordeaux was famous because of the show, right? You know, it was a revered vintage. And so, you know, it was interesting. But yeah, there's some quirks in there that you're like, they dropped the ball. But pretty much, I think one of the producers was a big wine drinker, considered himself an onophile. And so I think, you know, that really creeped into the show. It was amazing. That show just had a special place in my heart. You know, I think, you know, it's because of that show that I'm here. You know, I mean, it wasn't like I watched that show and wanted to do exactly what I'm doing now. I watched that show and it made me feel like I was missing out. FOMO, right? You know, it's like,
yeah,
like they had wine. They were drinking wine. The conversations and the camaraderie that they had built around wine was something that I felt that I was missing in my life. And I was like, oh, maybe if I had wine in my life, you know, I could have this. You know, they were funny. That, you know, Frasier was like on paper, he was an amazing guy, right? You know, it's like, you know, collected African art, was sophisticated, had the baby grand in his apartment. You know, it was amazing. I don't know. The show just really struck me in a place where I felt like I wanted to have wine in my life. And I felt, and also it made it, because it was humorous, it made it a little bit more welcoming, right? You know, I think from the outside looking in, when we're talking about the wine world, you know, it's, you know, if there is pretense there, you know, I think a lot of times when you don't see a lot of people who look like you doing an activity or participating in something, then some days you feel like it may not be for you. And so by watching that show, you know, it somehow I felt if I could arm myself with a few comedic anecdotes from the show about wine, somehow it would protect me when I walked into a store. You know, the greatest, you know, foil to pretension is humor. And so that show made me feel safe in some way, or made me feel confident about not knowing enough to walk it through the front door, knowing enough to kind of laugh it off. And that was critical. And so, you know, I would go into the wine store, you know, whatever, I had $15, $25, $35, whatever it was, and basically just talked to the guy in the store and was like, hey, I have $13 today. You know, I'm feeling like, you know, maybe something red, not heavy. You know what I mean? Like, just put it in my, as I start to get to know them. But, you know, I think everybody in the wine business has that, talks about like when you caught the bug, right? I caught the bug and it was like over. And I ended up going back to working in restaurants, but it seemed like a natural thing for me, right? You know, I was a waiter in a restaurant. It seems like if I was moving into wine, the natural progression would be this thing called a sommelier, which I had never heard of, right? You know what I mean? I was like, well, wait a minute. If I could put these two things together, then maybe this would work out for me. But Frasier was that, that moment, you know, like I watched, it was still, the season still hadn't ended yet. You know, I think the season ended and I was already a sommelier and I was living in New York, you know, but it was, you know, being able to, you know, I wasn't one of those people where I watched every Thursday.
Right. Yeah.
It was you know, they were playing back episodes and I would binge and watch them laying on the sofa. But it was just, it was like, you know, I give them a lot of credit for, you know, piquing my interest and they, you know, them on the show really made me feel comfortable about not knowing enough and being able to laugh at myself when I walked in, you know what I mean?
Oh God. Yeah. And I love the line, prepare to get stomped like a late harvest Gewürztraminer. I went back preparing for this interview and I went back and watched all these Frasier lines and I'm angry that Frasier went from like a mid 70s Chambertin to serving a Beaujolais and I'm yelling at the screen. I mean, you can't pick something in the middle. Like you went from that to that. I mean, even if it's Cru Beaujolais, get out of here, Frasier. But there's a lot there. I want to get, there's a lot I want to get to. And I guess let's start with just making wine more comfortable for people. Before I get to your journey, you were sort of mentioning your first answer about just making it more accessible, which is sort of the point of this podcast. And I'm wondering, how important is that for you, for your philosophy? I mean, I'm holding a bottle of the Other People's Pinot that I had last night. I'll talk about it in a little bit. And shout out to Noble Estates, who represent some of your wines here in Southern Ontario. But how important is it to make wine accessible?
Well, I mean, it just is. It was never anything that I had set out to do. It just, you know, it's just me being authentic to me allowing me to be who I am. And whoever came along for the ride came along for the ride. It wasn't like this idea that I, easily in hindsight, I can go back and say, oh yeah, I planned this the whole way, but it wasn't. It was just me just wanting to find like-minded people. The way that I wanted to interact with wine wasn't what I had, pictures of what I had seen before. And the fact that I wanted to speak to a younger audience about wine, I just felt like I can interject my humor. And then people started to come along. Like, I think, you know, I mean, you can actually see me, but like, you know, nothing about me says I enjoy wine, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, it shouldn't be, right? But like, generally I'll walk into a store or I walk into any room. I'm the last person that anybody thinks knows anything about wine. And for me, I just wanted to celebrate that fact, right? You know what I mean? And you know, I think that, like I said, it all goes back to like before. I think you can be serious about your craft and also have another side, you know, and have humor and tell the same story a different way. And for us, we just wanted to make great wine that was inexpensive, that people can relate to. I feel like the wine's over-delivered. You know, there's lots of double entendres and meanings to the things that we do, you know, OPP, like the idea of like just the packaging alone, it's supposed to question its quality, right? It's supposed to question your opinion about its quality, right? Because when you look at it, it does look like my 4-year-old, you know, drew the label.
Yeah.
But the idea, it's not supposed to be, wine is supposed to be fun. And you know, if you want to be serious about it, you can dig into it. But you know, I guess as it's developed over the years, you know, it's become an important part about who I am and the people who follow or the people who believed in what I've been doing or support what I've been doing is that, you know, that be yourself. And hopefully, you know, I think there's lots of people. I mean, I get thousands of emails a month about wanting to break into the industry or somehow they had our wine and they didn't know wine could be this way. And you know, that's very flattering. You know, it's very flattering that way. I have to say that I didn't really, to be honest, I never really set out to demystify it for everybody else, right?
Yeah.
It was for me to, it was more of a creative outlet for me to feel that, but I've realized how it's morphed into that. And it's great, you know, I mean, it's about power to the people. Other people's Pinot is about everybody who had a hand in making that wine can afford that wine, right? You know what I mean? I think if there's a who work on our, you know, picking teams, bottling line, sorting table, all those things that, you know, the backbone that really make these things happen, you know, a lot of those people, they're not spending $55, $45 on a bottle of Pinot Noir from Oregon. And for me, it was just like this thing of like wanting to be able to make something that everybody could afford. You know, obviously we're talking about wine and I'm not, you know, I don't have my head up my ass, right?
Yeah.
$15 is a lot of money for someone who's spending on wine, right? It could be, right? So
yeah,
I know that. So, but for us, I wanted to speak to a younger audience. And you know, I was looking for people who were like me, that got the humor, that understood the wine. And, I didn't go out looking for them. I thought if I made wine, they would come looking for me. And so, it's morphed into that. I mean, and a lot of people, I feel like I've made it really comfortable for a lot of people to be themselves. Right. And I think that you see that all across the spectrum. Serious people making wine, but not taking themselves serious. It's just not a marketing ploy anymore when something's cheeky.
And by the way, you should know that this wine we used is a different vintage. I'm part of a private club called the National Club here in Toronto. It's going to have the image of being a snooty club. And we do, I host wine events all the time. And we use this and it was very well enjoyed a couple of years ago.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, no, it's really good. But I'm curious, and you mentioned how people will look at you and they think, oh, that guy doesn't know wine. And maybe it's a more casual shirt, the hat, the sunglasses, but how much of it growing up and you getting into the business and your credentials are incredible in terms of winning like a best young sommelier competition, working at the French Laundry. I mean, damn, that is a short amount of people that have those things on their list. But how difficult was it on your journey because of your skin color that maybe people looked at you and assumed, oh, that guy's not going to know anything about Chambou Moussigny?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's no different. I'd have to say it's no different than any other part of my life. I don't live in the neighborhood where everybody looks like me, right? It's, you know what I mean? You know, I had to welcome diversity into my life as well. And so, you know, throughout my life, you know, I went to private school, boarding school. I've always been that person. I don't call it lonely. I think, you know, maybe when I was younger, there might've been feelings of that, you know, less about that now, because I think I connect with people not based on what they look like. But you know, I think there were some barriers, but like you don't know because it's not blatant, right? You know, when I walk into on a sales call, I don't know that, like, when I leave, they're like, fuck this guy. What is this OPP want? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. They're like, you know, I don't know, right? Because, like, you know, if they don't buy, they don't buy. Maybe it doesn't fit. Maybe they think it was good. Like, whatever. I'm selling something which they can, you know, whatever reason, you know, maybe they don't like me. It could just be like, hey, the wine's not good. You know, so I don't dwell on those things. And I can't get wrapped up in those things. Otherwise, you know, that sucks up too much energy. It would make you angry. You know, I mean, I'd rather choose to use that energy to go to count the no's, right? To go to the next, let's go to the next account, to the next account. You meaning to tell me that in the whole world, I can't sell this to anybody, right? I can't get anybody to say that this is good, or, you know what I mean? Like, that's how I look at it. I look at, like, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we sell X amount of cases, whatever. And everybody's like, that's great. And I was like, well, no, it's not. If I only sold that in New York, maybe that's great. But I have the whole world to sell to. I don't set barriers for myself like that. And so, you know, yeah, I'm sure there were, you know, I mean, I worked at French Laundry per se. I'd come up to the table. They didn't think I was a sommelier. I said, hey, you were ready to talk about wine? You know, because I'm standing next to the table, I can hear, right? Part of being a great service, providing great service, is listening, watching body cues, you know, all these other different things. So, you know, the waiter comes to the table, the captain comes to the table and says, you know, we can have the sommelier come by. And they're like, yeah, sure, bring the sommelier by. I walk up to the table, said, hey, we're ready to talk about wine. And they're like, we're waiting for the sommelier.
Oh, no, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's what I'm talking about. Like that, like, I'm not offended by that, right? Right? Mm-hmm. I'm empowered by that. You just make me stronger. When I come to the table, I got your ass already. You know what I mean? You don't even know, right? And that, like, I felt like I get to choose how I feel about that moment, those kind of moments. And I chose to feel empowered, right? Because like, I got one of the best jobs in the world to do what I do. And you didn't even see me coming. You didn't even know. And it happens, all the time. I mean, selling wine, I'm at some place in Colorado and the owner of the store is kind of following me around because, he's like, can I help you? And I said, no, I'm here on a sales call with Bob, the sales rep. There's a queue. So I'm walking around the store. What better way to get to know the buyer than walk around the store and see, right? If there's any connections, I got 20 minutes, right? So I want to see if any of my friends are on the shelves, just some interesting things like, oh, wow. Oh, hey, dude, I really enjoyed those wines. Like, that's my thing. But he just kept following me around the store, because he didn't believe that was true. It's like, dude, I could write you a check for your fucking store today. Yeah. Right? Like I'm not here for that. But those things always happen, right? They always happen. And I just say, in my mind, I just say, all right, that means that I just need to work harder, right? It's because they're just not used to seeing someone who looks like me in this position or this role. And that's how I choose to handle it. It's like, I haven't worked hard enough yet, right? That I haven't inspired more people of color that look like me to be a part of this industry. I haven't worked hard enough to be more profound in the industry. You know what I mean? It's always directed at me. And I just keep moving, right? It's just like, hey, I'm just going to work harder. And none of that matters. It's like, I still get to do what I want to do. I still get to live my dream, right? You know what I mean? So like, but it those things were always there. Those are just a few, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like,
hey, can I say a weird question? Have you seen Good Will Hunting?
Yes.
Okay, so whenever you're dealing with one of these assholes at a wine store, or when you're at French Laundry, did you ever want to go full Matt Damon in the bar, where he totally just uses all his knowledge to squash bag in one of those early scenes? Were you ever tempted? Because I feel if I was in your place, I'd be tempted to do that.
In the beginning, it was like that, right? But like the idea was that I'm busy. I don't need to get into wine smackdown with you.
Fair.
I don't have to prove to you that I belong here. I'm already here.
Yeah. Okay. No, good. Yeah.
All right. You know what I mean? I'm here. I run the program. Those three other guys, they work for me. They work under me. I'm responsible for them. Right. So, those days, some of those days it did happen. Some of those days were, some of those days, I'd be ridiculous. Like, it's like, oh yeah, my great, great grandfather, used to be the cellar master for Thomas Jefferson. Right. You know what I mean? I just make up shit. Right. You know what I mean? Absurd. We used to call it the wine smackdown. Dude, it's a Saturday night. I don't need to get into it with you, right? Hey, let me ask you this. What business are you in? You're in banking? Great, right? This is my business. This is what I do, right? You might be older than me. You might have drank this DRC. You might have had this wine more than me, but you haven't had this wine more than me in the last 3 months. I've tasted this wine 8 times, 10 times. With Albert Different Lane, like, fuck you, right? You know what I mean? Like, so, like, some days you get into those things, but you realize that it's a waste of your time. Like, I get it. Like, you've been there. You might have been drinking wine longer than I've been alive. But for what I do, I taste these wines every single day, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like the average was what, $25,000 a night was spent on wine. Come on.
What does DRC taste like? I still haven't had it.
No. It depends on which one. Oh man, don't even get me started. 66.
All right, then how about this? One DRC moment, one vintage that sticks out for you.
I would only have to say 85 Latoche is because a gentleman, a VP of Goldman Sachs comes in, used to come in regularly. And I think now he's like got some underlings that came with him, and they were supposed to be 8 and then they all squeezed and it was 11 or 13 around a small private dining room table. And I opened one bottle and you know, you got to, you know, you pour a little bit for the host, and then you got to make it all the way around the table with one bottle.
Yeah.
Oh. And, you know, I had one guy who's like, hey, just give me a little bit, give me a little bit more. And I gave the guy a little bit more. And then when I, time I got back to the host, it was just like, you know, a few drops. And I was like, fuck.
Oh.
Yeah. The bottle's like $8,000, $9,000. You know, you know, I felt bad, but, you know, because it is my job. I mean, I made it around the table. I made it all the way around the table. It's just the host who was paying for it didn't get as much as everybody else, right? So I did my job. I made it around the table. But also, he's done this before. He knows that, like, stretching a bottle for 13 people is not a lot, you know? So anyways, but, you know, I just, you know, I mean, I had all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So that's the story I tell when I think about Latosh. And, you know, I don't really talk about DRC anymore because they tried to sue me over some t-shirts. So we don't talk about that.
All right, move on.
I'm in legal battles.
Yeah. Wow. by the way, good for you. You're not getting in legal battles with tiny wineries or wineries of little note. You're getting in legal battles with the big guys, you know?
Legends.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for you. By the way, everyone at that table should have been fired by saying, give me a little bit more. If the boss is getting that bottle, you take your 1.5 ounce and you shut up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'd love to hear about the Best Young Sommelier in America competition. Just for people who don't know what a wine competition is all about, I was wondering if you could go through some of the broad strokes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very similar. If anybody's ever seen the movie Somme, it's kind of very similar. This was the first year that the Court of the Master Sommeliers took over the judging and the competition. And so what happened is, you know, basically it's broken down into three parts. You have your theory. So that's basically questions. You know, so it's the written part of the exam. Boom, boom, boom. You know, do you know this? Do you know that? You know, there's only three grapes in the world. Name the three grapes in the world that bleed red juice. You know, all those kind of whacked out questions, right? So it's the questions. And then there was a practical. And so the practical is basically, you know, a mock service. Sitting at the table, you know, they're pelting you with questions, asking all kinds of stuff. There's always a difficult customer asking, hey, give me more, give me more. You're decanting, they make you double decant. Like, you're, you know, like, you're talking about stuff. It's just basically, how do you handle a table and getting through that service? And then the next part is, you know, more sort of the parlor trick of it all. It's called blind tasting. And so, you know, at this time it was basically 6 whites and 6 reds. So it's 12 wines. And then basically when we talk about blind, it's not, obviously you're not blindfolded, but that would be kind of cool. But the idea is to really, you know, to really kind of remove yourself from bias of particular wines, grape varietals or regions, and really kind of get down to the brass tacks. And can you taste this wine without seeing the label and understanding where it came from, and breaking it down, you know, you use the grid, blah, 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 blah. But so on that particular day, I got 9 out of 12, and I lived my moment. I was the best that day. You know?
Do you remember what some of the wines were you got right?
Oh, yeah, I think I called producer on, what was it? Gessen. I think it's called Gessen Sauvignon Blanc. That's the one I called producer on that one. There was a Gruner Veltliner. There was Chianti. There was Burgundy, red Burgundy. I don't know all the whole list of wines. I have them written down somewhere. I haven't gone through. Maybe that was in maybe that's in my stuff in storage. You know, that kind of thing. My thing with storage is if I haven't been to my storage unit in like 8 months,
throw it out.
I don't need it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I think
the wines are somewhere, but, yeah, so it was an interesting foray into it. You know, I felt like I was just really competing against myself. You know, I just wanted to know where I stood, you know, because I think, you know, a lot of this stuff it's self-administered. So like, even through the Court of the Master Sommeliers, it's not a place that you show up every single day and learn. You know, you learn on your own and you study on your own. And then you go, and it might be a 3-day seminar or something like that. And at the end, it's, you know, the test, you know, so, you know, I'm doing all this on my own and not really sure, you know, am I getting it? You know, and if you don't use it, then, you know, do you really know? You know, at this particular point, people weren't coming in asking for Sancerre. right? You know what I mean? So it's like, well, shit, you know what I mean? That, you know, remember, and like, and also like, I'm sure it's probably not a predominant test question now, but you know, and all the test questions, like name the 13 grapes, you know, how many grapes can be used in Chateau Neuf du Pape? Like, you know, it was you know, so I don't know if that's a big question anymore because everybody kind of knows that now. So, you know, for me, I just really wanted to know where I stood. I just really wanted to know, do I actually know this shit? I've been reading, I've been drinking, like I just like tasting, studying, like, do I really know it? And that's how I went into the competition. I didn't, there were, you know, guys from all over the country. And, you know, so, you know, I'm like, ooh, wow, damn, this guy works at Gary Danko. Wow, this person works here. Like, you know, and I wasn't struck by that because I just really wanted to know where I stood.
Right. By the way, calling producer, good on you. That's impressive. So was there a bottle? Was there a moment where you got the bug? I mean, beyond, of course, Fraser and Niles, you know, fighting over a California Bordeaux blend. Was there a moment for you that really got you, that you realized you needed to be in wine?
Yeah, I think it was more of an experience. It was a bottle. It's so funny, right? Because everybody has this moment and it's always like, you know, some wine, you know, some unicorn wine. And mine was just, it was Vos Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
You know, a Napa Valley producer. I had taken a new job at the steakhouse and we were opening it. So, you know, we were a part of the opening team and like the third night of training, was the first night of our wine tasting. And, you know, we tasted we tasted like maybe 75% of the wines on the wine list. It was a small list, but it was broken up into two nights. We did whites one night and then we did reds the other night, but it was the first night that, it was the first time I ever had multiple glasses of wine in front of me. So I have to tell you that was an experience that I had never really experienced before. You know, obviously, you know, I've had multiple wines at a sitting, and if you do a tasting, generally speaking, you know, you chug what's in your glass when the new wine's coming, right? You know what I mean? So that's the closest you ever get to having, you know, a wine in the same glass. But like the idea of having Vos Sauvignon Blanc in one glass and having, you know, this California producer Chardonnay in the other, it really showed me that it was different. Like in my mind, you know, you say it's different, but being able to vacillate between both glasses was just like this thing. I was like, holy shit. You know, and I'm like, and obviously, you know, the wines are from different region, but it was like right there in my face. And I mean, that was the moment where I was like, I got to be a part of this. Like, this is like fascinating, amazing. And then at the time, the beverage director for the whole steakhouse company was actually the general manager from Philadelphia. And he was there. And it was just everything, right? You know, I think a lot of my friends talk about the sharpest guy dressed in the restaurant is the sommelier, right? You know, it's like the guy that's the most dapper is the sommelier. And here it was, the guy who was running the wine program was just an accomplished individual, had a JD degree, you know what I mean? Like went to Princeton, you know what I mean? And to boot, like, you know, I mean, all the like superficial shit that doesn't really matter. But when you're young, you're like, wow. His car is not even in the state. He's in the state of Texas. His car is in Pennsylvania, but he's got his Porsche car key hooked to his belt. You know, you're like, well, shit, there's money in it. You know what I mean? I'm thinking of all these things. I'm like, you know, maybe I can make a real living at it, you know? But it was that night tasting the white wine tasting and then just being struck in awe of the differences and how different this Vos Sauvignon Blanc was, that I was just like, you know what, I'm gonna do this. This is, and it was from that moment on that I was like, every waking moment, this is, my life's gonna be about this.
Nice.
And, you know.
Yeah, no, we all have those stories, and it is cool when you realize, wait a minute, they look the same, but they taste so different, or they're not that far away, and yet they taste, it's crazy. So, I was wanting to talk a little bit about, I got the 2018, other people's Pinot, had it last night. For me, just a lot of dark red cherry. There was so much spice and cooking and cinnamon and earth and on the palate, I got a little bit more fruit than I did spice. Good medium plus finish. I guess the first place, just tell people why Willamette Valley, why Oregon why that area is so special for Pinot.
For me, you know, I've always considered Oregon Pinot Noir to kind of be the best of both worlds, right? It has that fruit that you associate with California meets the terroir or the taste of the land of the old world. And it's in this very glorious place called the Willamette Valley. It is a true valley. Not to get technical, but it's a true valley. You know, it's the Van Duzer, in my opinion, it's the Van Duzer corridor that makes it great. You know, it's the break in the coastal ranges that brings in the cool climate, maritime influences to cool down the valley. It gives you really hot days, so the grapes can ripen phenolically, but then it gives you the cool nights so it can retain its acidity. It struggles there. When I first started getting there, you know, we were harvesting like mid-October. You know, things have changed drastically. It wasn't as hot. You know, we didn't have a lot of 100 degree days as now we do. But, you know, it was just enough for the grape to struggle. And when you got it right, you got it right. And it was beautiful. And my thing is, it's like, you know, people talk about a lot of different things, right? Oh, it's, it's Burgundy with training wheels and it's this and that, you know, but I just felt, you know, I have always, in my heart, it just, you know, every domestic Pinot Noir producer holds Burgundy as this beacon of light at which they aspire to make, right? And we all were smart enough to know that we can't, but it's the care and take of what the Burgundian vignerons take is what it's probably what we admire the most. And so for me, Oregon was the place. You know, I had made a little bit of wine in California, but at that particular point, you know, the kind of stars aligned. A good friend of mine, who's a movie producer, bought some of the great vineyards in America. He bought the Occidental Vineyard that Kistler made famous. He bought Seven Springs Vineyard in Oregon that everybody made famous. And, you know, it was that alignment that got me there. It was always near and dear to my heart. It was, the section, the Willamette Valley Pinot Noir section on the per se wine list was, you know, a lot of that was my creation. Like, you know, the fleshing it out, you know, just really over-representing it to some degree. Was something that I was really into. And then when I got a chance to go and be a part of, to go look at this, the first part of this project, you know, because Seven Springs was just a vineyard, you know, they didn't make wine. And so the idea of being able to go was something that just struck with me. But it makes it to me, like I said, and also I think that like we, you know, our first wine, you know, we made some wines from Seven Springs. And my whole idea was that we all want to mimic the style Burgundy, but like I think sometimes, you know, chasing that, we lose sight of what we have in front of us. It's a masterpiece and it's of its own. It's kind of like most counterfeiters, right? You know, when you look at Dutch counterfeiters, they counterfeit paintings, a lot of those guys, they were enamored with the work, so you know, with Rembrandt, and so much so that they were painting them, and then they realized that like, wow, we're trying to emulate his thing, but ours, you know, I think some of the most expensive Rembrandts sold are not Rembrandts. They're actually counterfeits, right? It's this idea of like the master and the student, and that idea that like so much so that we were entrenched in, at least I was entrenched in like Burgundy, Burgundy, Burgundy. Like we're like trying to force it to make it fit that under like what we had underneath was something that was special and unique to the world in itself. And then I think, you know, obviously the people in the Valley get that. Otherwise, you know, I mean, it's been 55 years, but that was, to me, it was just special. And even like just regionally, the people were special. It was different than California. It wasn't commercialized, and not to say that that's bad or anything like that, but like, it was just a different feel. And, there's camaraderie, and it wasn't, you know, and, you know, financial stuff, right? It was a lower cost of entry for me, right? It wasn't expensive as Napa. So, you know, those things contributed to it. But all in all, you know, it was my favorite place domestically that Pinot Noir was being made. And, it's a very beautiful, lovely place that produced, you know, amazing, amazing, amazing fruit.
Yeah.
And wine.
Yeah, it does. And it's funny, every winery I go to that makes Pinot, whether it's in California or in Ontario, at some point, some of them feel apologetic and they feel insecure. Like, oh, no, we're Burgundian. We're Burgundian. We're not this North American thing. We're Burgundian. Like, no. Be you, but take away some of the lessons, you can from Burgundy.
Yeah.
I know we're near at a time. and I feel cognizant of your time. You have four children, correct?
Yes.
You have four children, and are you owning or building or running restaurants? Or a bar? Did I read a bar or something, or a bakery?
Yeah. So I split my time between the East Coast and the West Coast. I married a New Yorker. Yeah. My wife wrote a New York Times most notable book. We met at Per Se. Fast forward, we do have four children, four boys, ranging from 12 to 18 months. We have a brownstone. We live in, I'm here in Brooklyn. I've been quarantining here in Brooklyn. I spent about, I get on the plane a lot. I get on the plane almost every single week. I think last year was about 47 weeks out of the year. So I'm gone. And I spent a lot of time in Oregon. I spent a lot of time on the road. Yeah. Bless you.
Thank you.
So for me, I'm constantly moving, but my love for restaurants is just something that I couldn't get away from. And I always wanted to own my place, my own place, me and my wife. And so we opened a small American ham bar, very reminiscent of the jamon bars that you find in Barcelona, mm-hmm. but everything's American. So American charcuterie, American cheese, old American wine from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And a little 20-seat bar about a minute and a half walk from our brownstone. And so we opened it. I signed the lease about 3 years ago, but we opened at the beginning of January right next door. Where I'm at now is our provision store. So it's the other storefront in the building. So same footprint, but this is like our deli version. So everything that you can get next door, you can get here to kind of to go. So you can get all the country hams sliced to go. You can get cheeses, small batch groceries. Over here, we focus on craft beer and a little bit of and cider. And then about a year ago, almost 2 years ago, my wife and I, we bought a wine store on the same street. So if you go four blocks down, we own a 200 square foot wine store called Vineyard. And so we've kind of been creating our own world on this street. And then in between the ham bar and the wine store, we're opening a bakery. I signed the lease probably about 2 months ago. And so we have over there, we bought a stone mill. So we're going to be making our own flour. We're starting a flour company, but then we're baking bread. So bread for wholesale and bread for our other ventures. So we're keeping very busy on the street. During the quarantine, during the whole COVID, we signed the lease over there. We opened this place, which is called Ann Sun's Buttery. Ann Sun's Ham Bar is next door. And, just keeping busy, someone said, what do you do in your downtime? It's like,
You don't have downtime. With that and four kids, I imagine you don't sleep and you don't binge watch a lot of TV shows. Jeez, that's impressive. That is so impressive.
I'm lucky. My wife's pretty independent, and I think, a lot of times in relationships, if one is living the dream and one isn't, then there could be friction. But, my wife really wanted to be the architect of our children's education. That's something that she takes very seriously, put her writing career on hold for. She's doing what she's very confident in what she's doing. And she's like, hey, go build your company. And so, for the past 10 years, I basically got on a plane on Monday. That was a travel day. I worked Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I either took the last flight out on Thursday or, red eye on Thursday or the 6 a.m. flight, the earliest flight on Friday. And then I was home for dinner for the weekend. Took the kids to soccer, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? And then Monday I left again. This is the first time that, that it hasn't, that I haven't been getting on a plane. But, I've been lucky, it's true, right? It's like I get to spend probably the same amount of time as most fathers do with their children. It's just in chunks, right? So like, normally we go to the Willamette Valley for the summer. We just move and go to our house there. A couple of years ago, I moved our whole family to France for 4 months, right? So we still get to do that. Work-life balance lines have blurred because it's something that I enjoy doing. I don't consider it work. The V word is a bad word in our house, and that's vacation. You know what I mean? That's something that, you know, I don't do. You know, and like, and maybe it's vacation for my family, but for me, it's not. You know, I'm there, but you know, I'm still, you know, I don't disconnect. And yeah. So that's kind of our thing. But yeah, no, we do like, you know, I do regular day stuff. Like we got a flat the other day. I had, you know, I changed the flat, and then, you know, my assistant made an appointment. So we're going to take the car to go get it, you know, new tires. So I'm taking a couple of my boys with me, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I go pick them up, you know, so they're always around and, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah, man, you know, I stopped watching TV a long time ago. I remember someone told me, it's like, you think about this, you pay your cable bill. So you're paying someone to watch them fulfill their dreams instead of going to fulfill your own dreams. And, you know, that was pretty profound for me. And, you know, and I was like, oh yeah, you're right. And, you know, I mean, and obviously, yeah, I watch movies. Yeah. I'm a big sports fan. Yeah. Yeah. I go to, you know, I mean, I work those things then, but it doesn't, a lot of that doesn't consume me. I don't, you know, I don't care. Like, you know, it's like when you're entrenched in what you're doing, it, you know, it's got weight. It's there, you know, pop a bit, I'm ready.
I will say this as we end. First, what a great relationship and partnership you have with your wife and your family. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, Andre, you've taken a lot of time. We haven't even, like, I'd love to interview you somewhere down the road. There's so much other stuff. But I was wondering if you could tell people when they're at the LCBO here in Southern Ontario or wherever throughout, when they see horseshoes and hand grenades, which, by the way, that is a fun, opulent, jammy, wonderful, but balanced wine, or the OPP. I was wondering if you could just tell people what they should expect and why they should give your wines a shot.
You know, I mean, for me, I've always worked in restaurants. You know, I always, you know, coming from that, I worked for chef-driven restaurants, which meant that the chef never cared about anything else except his food. You know, there's a reason why they ordered the food first and the menu came and the wine list came afterwards, right? The wine was always there to make the food, to complement the food, right? I wouldn't say taste better because the chef would probably strangle me. But so the idea, I wanted to take, you know, my philosophy about, you know, from working with food, what I've known, and apply that to wines that we make. The common thread throughout all our wines is acid. Acid's an amplifier, right? The reason why you put salt on food, lemon on seafood, is to really crank up the flavors of the dish. You know, we wanted to make wines that were not only transparent and honest and truly spoke of the place that they came from. They're not tricked out. They're not overly ripe. They're not overly oaked. You know what I mean? We wanted to strip all of those things away so that the wine can shine, but also, you know, complement the food. And, you know, and I say that, you know, also, you know, our wines, for me, they're supposed to make your life better. They're complements to life, condiments to life, right? Like that book you're reading, it's supposed to make that book you're reading, the music, the album you listen to. I love City in Color. I love that band. That's my favorite band. And, which is based in Toronto.
That's right.
But I love, and they, supposed to make that album, you know, better that you're listening to, your conversations with friends better, you know, that's really where we wanted to be. You know, wine is for us is more of a lifestyle and not just a drink.
You know what? Absolutely. When the Raptors beat Golden State last year, I had one of my favorite Ontario sparkling and I opened it up in the radio studio I was working in and gave everyone a small pour just to enjoy that moment. Andre, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know how busy you are. The creator of Maison Noir Wines, check them out. They're easy to spot at the whatever liquor store, wine store, LCBO you're at. Really appreciate you joining the show.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for everyone listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.